The reason why we chose Prolog is that in this set and Linkop is that in this setup, there is a very direct connection between prover actions and programs. In Linkop, an action is nothing but a Prolog clause. A program is nothing but a set of clauses that are ordered. So it's very easy to insert a program to places where we would expect an action. It's rather straightforward to use the same feature extraction. So it's very good for quick prototyping. Okay, so basically I have to explain two steps here, how we select clauses, and then explain to you how we order these clauses. For close selection, we explored a couple options. We spent more time on two options. The first one is to look at proof steps that are instances of a particular action, and then find the common abstraction of these instances. So we compute the least generalization of all the instances. This is something which can give us back the fully general action, but very often it will give us something more specific. Another option that we looked at is to identify frequent action sequences and then just combine them into a single macro action. This is pretty much what is happening in binary pair encoding, a standard technique in language modeling. Once we have selected and abstracted a couple clauses, we order them. We don't yet have a principled approach for doing this ordering, but the most important heuristics that we've looked at is first is how specific the various clauses are. Basically, if one clause has a head which is more specific than another clause head, then the more specific comes first. So here in this example, we have a clause head which is f of x. This is this is more specific than the head of the other clause f of x. So we want in our program to first try this and then try this. For those of you who are not familiar with Prolog, a Prolog clause is a very simple structure. The head is basically something which is going to be unified with the goal we are trying to prove, and the body is a list of new goals that we need to prove. So we are reducing the head to the goals in the body. Besides specificity, we look at frequency statistics in the proofs that we've collected, and we try to explore clauses that are more frequent in the proofs. I'll try to show you a very simple example of how this works. It's using the theory of Robinson arithmetic, which defines basic properties of addition and multiplication on the positive integers. You can see the axioms here. This theory contains equality, and Linkop handles equality by explicitly adding some axioms that deal with equality. These are the axioms that are added. So this is the theory that that this is the axiom set that we work with in this example. And then we are going to train BLCOP on a set of simple equalities. They will be in the format A times B equals C or A plus B equals C. So it's all super simple. The prover is going to solve some of these. Typically, it's going to solve those that have shorter proofs. As long as the Monte Carlo research is not guided, it's very similar to a breadth first search. So we'll have some proofs that are relatively short, and then we look at these proofs. We look at the instances of a particular proof action and then generalize them so that they collapse into a single clause. And then we order them based on generality and frequency. And then we end up having this program. It's, you can see it does have a bunch of quite sensible clauses. For example, the first one tells you that if you multiply something with zero, then you get zero. The second clause tells you how to add b plus one. It tells you that you should first add b and then increase that number by one. And but then there are a couple other clauses. This one is quite nonsensical. This one is an important one, but it's not important for this particular program set. So we get good ones, good clauses, bad clauses as well. But so what happens when we run run this prologue code on some equalities? It will prove some of them, but very often it will fall into infinite loop. But fortunately, the way it falls into infinite loop has a very strong pattern. Basically, it's going to try to prove the very same goal over and over and again. And in the connection calculus, it's a well-known optimization that we can just disallow proofs that involve proving the same goal, using the same goal to prove that same goal again. So basically, we can just say that whenever a goal that we're in the process of proving appears again, then we stop. We treat that branch as a failure and then go to the next branch. It's very, in order to implement that, we cannot run this program directly on Prolog, but we can write a very simple interpreter which makes sure of this loop checking. And then if we see a loop, it fails. And with this addition, the above program is actually going to be able to prove any statement of the form A plus B equals C or A times B equals C. So it nicely generalizes to the problem class. And then we can do some cleaning. We can iteratively go over the clauses and see what happens if we remove them, check if the coverage changes. And with this, we can remove a bunch of unnecessary clauses. What this is the program that we end up having. It looks very much like what a human would write. to implement addition and multiplication. So it's just nice to recover something which is easy to understand and generalize as well. Now, of course, it works nicely for simple domains like Robinson arithmetic, but the challenge is how to generalize it to harder domains. We are working on that, so this is work in progress. But this is the rough idea, and I'm going to conclude here just to remind the whole idea of this project is to generate programs from proof traces using inductive logic programming and then insert these programs into the action space, which makes basically it makes the whole search less burdened by mechanistic parts. And I'm going to stop here. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. There is a online question from Polu.
Thanks. But in the program that you show on slide 16,
yeah,
so that's a sequence of actions, right? That
yes.
applies to the goals as they are produced. So in that program, if the first close, you call them close, right?
Yes.
If the first, so the first line, if the first line doesn't unify, the program is entirely discarded, right?
If the first line doesn't unify, it just goes into the second line.
Okay, so it fails safe through the lines?
Yes, so it's performing, it tries to unify the first close, and if it doesn't work, it goes to the second, and so on.
But it's... sorry, go ahead.
The Prolog program is really a search mechanism. Of course, it's a little it's challenging to ensure that it's going to terminate, but it's only going to fail when it has exhausted all its options.
And so, if you generate new subgoals, let's say using the third clause generates a new subgoal, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so, if you generate a new subgoal, you restart the whole program on that?
Yes. Yes, exactly. You have a new goal, and then again you look at what close heads unify with this. In this particular example, you don't have very different kinds of close heads. It's basically everything is an equality, but what unifies depends on the arguments of the equality.
Yeah.
So it's a depth first search. A Prolog program is a depth first.
Okay, and the program itself has been created by observing those clauses being applied sequentially in the wild, right?
In the proofs, yeah.
And so you've seen some proof. There is a bunch of proof that applies those clauses in that order. That's the reason why you got that.
So the proofs are messy. So you don't get something like that in the proofs. They do all sorts of unnecessary steps. And then we try to first of all by raising these steps to some common abstract level, you get rid of particular cases. You don't care whether this rule was applied when adding to three or adding to four. So you abstract away from a lot of details. Here, and then you still here. You still have quite For example, this is a very dangerous step. It just keeps making your goal more and more complex. But it turns out that in the proofs that we found, in the proving attempts, this was just one of the actions, but in the successful attempts, this wasn't very often. It did happen a couple times, that's why it's here. But if it happens too often, it's not going to find a proof, especially because we don't, even in the proof search, we don't allow getting back to the same goal. So if you apply this and then apply this, you get back the same goal, and then we stop with filler during the initial proof search as well. So it cool. Just gives you a way to make your messy proofs somewhat nicer.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, so that's David. Yeah, sorry.
So, thanks for the talk. I had a question about a few questions. So, with the least general generalization, I guess this is the standard method that was used, just like the one from the 70s.
Yes.
Yeah. There it goes. I was wondering if you've considered that maybe in this case, like alternatives forms of least general generalization. Or under different equational theories?
So we've been talking about this, but currently no. No, I think it's a very, very important question, and I certainly don't want to claim that the least general generalization is the right approach. We're still learning more about inductive logic programming to try to figure out. I'm happy to, if you have pointers, I'm happy.
Yeah. So if you look me up, I've actually published a lot on least general generalization in the form of anti-unification. So there's, and that's one reason I was interested in asking about it. But yeah, we could talk somewhere else I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'd be happy. Thanks.
Any question here? No question here.
Yeah, okay, so I cannot see any online questions either. So let's thank George.
Thank you.
For the nice talk. And then, so Adrian is the next speaker. Adrian Cisarik on Solving Games. So is he online?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, hey Adrian.
Hi.
So Adrian will talk about solving arithmetic problems on a checkered paper. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So hi everyone, this is a joint work with three of my colleagues, Beatrix Benkő, Gergely Stonfai and Mirány Vásárhelyi. And first I will just briefly describe what this solving arithmetic problems on a checkered paper project is about. So imagine a elementary school boy or girl at a math exam where the teacher gives him or her a paper with a problem written on the top of it, like here, it's minus 85 plus 10. And this boy or girl have to work out the answer for that step-by-step in a step-by-step manner. And after that, when he or she came to an answer, there's a designated area here in the second row where he or she would have to write his answer, and then the teacher evaluates that by checking whether the steps of the deduction were okay, and also whether the final answer is okay. So this is the general thing, and we want to solve these things with machine learning, but without utilizing any external prover. So just the paper and the machine learning model. And basically you can think deep learning models specifically like transformers or things alike. And you can think of basic problems like addition, multiplication, division, or root, polynomial root finding, or probably some prime factorization or things alike. So I think I have to describe why we are interested in this. And we have some motivations, and one of the motivations is that the recent successes and half successes of the natural language processing language models in solving mathematical tasks. So there is a line of work in this regard, and there is the work of, for example, Sexton, who evaluate state-of-the-art language models to solve problems which I mentioned before. So typically the setup in these cases is visible on this slide. It's very simple. The problem is presented as a string to the language model, and the language model is conditioned on this string, and the language model has to generate the answer. So basically in this setup, the model is trained just by using input and desired output pairs, a bunch of them, millions of them, of course, but nothing else. And we argue that it's not natural, because when a 10-year-old child learns these kind of things, he does not learn in this manner. Rather, he learns algorithmic steps. And I said successes because there are a lot of problems which these natural language processing models can solve. But also, I said half successes because there are particular examples where they spectacularly fail. For example, the multiplication, seemingly simple problem, a state-of-the-art simple LSTM model cannot do more than 50% of the problems in this benchmark, or even a transformer model cannot achieve more than 75% accuracy on the test set in this benchmark. Another example is the listing of prime factors with each model family just reaching 10%. So there is clearly a gap here, which we think should be closed. And we do not just have a gap, but we see this missing of this part, that we should provide steps on how the model, language model, have to do this. That's an important point to make these models work on these problems. So let me tell you another motivation. So I have been working with Jolt myself with Robinson arithmetics and the Tableau method in a reinforcement learning setup with a quite modern machinery, the Proxima policy optimization. And we were having struggles like months to debug the system, for even to work with such simple problems, like I mentioned before, like addition and multiplication. So it was a pain. And you can imagine, of course, just a simple theorem like Bolzano theorem, and imagine that you start to work it out with the Tableau method, and you stop some point, and then you print the current proof tree and hand it to a mathematician. Probably most of the mathematicians would have no idea what's that on that paper. Even if he or she understands the Tableau method, even then it would be a struggle to work out the next step, or even to finish the proof easily. So that's another requirement we want. We want something more human-like to experiment with. And of course, here is my third motivation. Formalized human proof corpora are much more closer to human cognition, but the bar to enter this competition is quite high. So if you have to have the data set, the corpora, and even if you have the data set, the corpora, you have to know in depth the proof system, and the little details of the proof system could make your model go wrong. And if you are expert in that proof system, even then, the proof system itself have their own biases, with which you have to cope. So these are our requirements, and we want to come up something more simpler, which can be analyzed, and still yet it's usable for something. So our general aim is to find machine learning tasks and setups that are accessible to an average deep learning engineer, and one does not need a 1,000 TPUs for 2 weeks for a single training cycle, and one does not need to know in-depth specific proof systems. Still, these systems can be investigated in relation with human cognition or things alike. So these are our requirements, and our goals are the following. The most general goal is very general. So it's basically we want to identify inductive biases for human-like reasoning. So you can think of it like when the convolutions was basically almost perfect inductive biases for low-level human or computer vision, we search for something alike in this mathematical reasoning world. So, and we approach these questions from the perspective of some kind of human cognition side. We want to ask questions like, does the reasoning in state-of-the-art models resemble human-like reasoning? And if not, let's do so. So that's our program in general. But of course, it's a very, very general program setting. But that's what we want to do. And here we are. That's where we started to work on the grid paper project. So again, it's very simple. We want to solve elementary grammar school grade arithmetic task in a setup resembling a checkered or a grid paper. So it's really, it's very easy. It's like just a N by M grid, and there is a fixed symbol set, and in each cell of the grid, there is a symbol, and in one step, we can write a symbol in a cell, and the problem is written on the paper, on the top of the paper. It is the example -85 + 10, and we have to work out the example on the paper, and after we are done, we have to work out, we have to write the final answer in the second row with the same fixed symbol set S. So that's the setup. And some words about what are the particularities of this setup. So first, why simple arithmetic problems? So we think elementary school mathematics serves as a particularly suitable testbed because the necessary theory required is very narrow, and one has exact solutions with solid reasoning steps. And the most important thing is that so one can easily generate synthetic data sets for that, which is much more harder for the general mathematics. And still, we have unsolved problems here with language models, so there is a gap to be closed. And so we think these simple arithmetic problems are a good start. And why on a checkered paper and a grid paper? So firstly, simply because utilizing a paper for solving arithmetic problems is a rather natural approach. So that's a typical human behavior, that you grab a pen and a paper and start to write symbols, manipulate symbols, and you do some mechanical execution of straightforward algorithmic steps. So that's natural. That's the first answer. That's natural. And we have a very brave working hypothesis here that more complex mathematical reasoning also relies on the same fundamental approach of pattern matching. So almost the same thing happens with like these arithmetic problems, but with a more convoluted mathematical ideas. So another point here by a checkered paper is this checkered paper setup inherently has this step-by-step nature. So each step you write a symbol has this algorithmic bias a little bit with a very fine step granularity. And another third point, which is, I admit it's very vague, but still I think it's important to try some motivations like this, is that humans seems to be strongly conditioned to navigate well in 2D and 3D environments. So basically the evolution made us like that, to be to we can navigate in two-dimensional, three-dimensional spaces. And if the mind is conditioned on things like that, it's probably would provide a good bias for some algorithmic and problem-solving setups too. And when a mathematician works, he also works at the table, at a whiteboard or at a paper. So that's why we choose this checkered paper setup. So, and we have preliminary results, and we were at first very surprised. The result was that even a simple convolutional network, like you can think of a simple, I think it was 4 or 5 layers deep convolutional network, was able to have perfect accuracy on the task of predicting the next symbol to be written on the paper for various problems like addition. So here the input is simply the actual state of the paper, and the output of the network is simply a symbol and the place of the symbol where it should be written, and it just made the whole problem much more simpler. Of course, you can think that that's easy, but we have generalization. We have observed generalization also. What I mean by this generalization is that we trained on, I don't know, maximum of numbers up to 10,000 and tested the system on numbers up to 10 million, then the system could generalize and predict the next step of the addition problem almost perfect accuracy. So, and still this was like very basic networks, like convolutional networks. And of course, we want to test this whole idea on much more complicated models with transformers and so. So while it's important to note that we do not state here that the mathematical common sense reasoning or simple mathematical reasoning should be solved with a convolutional network. Of course, that's not our message. Our message here is that we have a clear gap. So the gap is that current state-of-the-art language models are not succeeding in these tasks. But when we provide step-by-step instructions, then it's a lot of things become much more easier. And there is this gap we think should be closed. And that's our general project is about. Let's find what inductive biases we should inject into the systems to close this gap. So even by, I tell you a simple example, we might analyze the attention structure came up in these models through good learning and compare with human attention results. So we can introduce different bottlenecks, and our aim is to see which bottlenecks we should introduce into the system to make the system much more better at these simple tasks. So the current state of the project is that we implemented step-by-step solutions for around half of the problems used in this Sexton et al. Paper. And our results are not conclusive because we miss a lot of different kinds of problems. So I cannot provide you a number which is comparable with that paper, but we observed very, very good results. And still, this is just a preliminary result, still we think we have a message. So we identified this gap, and there is this question of how should we close this gap. Even the question arises, should we close it? Or maybe higher level reasoning is the same as these simple reasonings in these simple problems. So hopefully we will at some point release these data sets, but it's really some cumbersome. So it was a little bit, it was take I don't know, 2 months to develop these step-by-step solutions. But hopefully we will, at some time we will release that. So thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, I hope I can answer it. And I have also a question that probably most of you or some of you have been thinking about this idea of how we, what happens if we try to mimic the elementary school or grammar school mathematics teachings for a machine learning system. And I'm just curious, what are your ideas? Is it worth to pursue this idea or what do you think about that? So thank you for your attention. And here is my contact if you hate Zoom.
Thank you.
So, Franz, sorry. So I just, we have an online question already. So, Francois. Yeah, so I'm sorry, Joseph.
Sure.
Okay. So let's start with Francois first. Then.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Hello. I'm Francois Charton. I've been working on arithmetic too. So I was sort of interested, and I had two questions. My experience is that addition is relatively easy to do with, say, transformers or similar problem, but multiplication is much more difficult, partly because sequences are longer, partly because, you know, in addition, you just have the carry is just one step away. Basically, attention is just on the previous digit or the next digit, but it stops there. Multiplication is much more long-ranged. So have you noticed in your methods that multiplication was significantly more difficult, or does it work pretty much the same as addition?
Thanks for the question. Yes, I can confirm and can confirm that that's it's significantly harder, the multiplication, with the same, because of the same reasons you have mentioned. So when you work it out on a paper, if you can make the problem easier here also, if you, for example, note on the paper the carry. So it can be made easier when you transform your problem and you give supervised signal to handle these carried bits. But yes, it's much more harder, and we have just preliminary results, I think they are promising, but I can't tell you yet that we have solved the multiplication at 100% test accuracy. So yes.
I had a second question, because in my experiments, I noted that for addition, but mostly for multiplication, the choice of the number representation, namely the number base that you use, was important. And there are results that confirm that in published papers. You know, they can do it in base 2, base 3. If you use balanced representation of numbers, you know, with negative digits, you get much better results, at least on transformers, basically because the addition or the multiplication tables have less carries. So have you tried, or do you intend to experiment on this? I know that Saxton worked on the base representation things, but as a specific job and not as an additional task for multiplication or for solving the problems.
Okay, so thanks for the suggestion. No, we haven't worked on that yet. We have just used base 10, like a regular thing. But thanks. I didn't know about these results, but yes, I think it's a good idea for sure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we have one or two questions here, Christian.
Yeah. So go ahead. So I cannot really see very well who is asking. So
boy, we need to come here.
My question is about details of the implementation. Do you predict the full checkerboard in one row, or do you predict each token individually, or and do you choose the position? What is your prediction mechanism, basically.
So I can barely hear you, but as I heard, the question was whether what we predict. So
yes,
what we predict is always one symbol, always the next symbol, condition on the previous symbol.
The position is given by is given. You cannot choose the position. Probably.
Yes, yes, yes. The position is not given. We also predict the position also. Oh. So we predict the symbol and the position of the symbol.
So you can write it in any order you like, and you get it's okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, but there is a supervised signal for that. So when we teach the system, we also give the signal where the symbols should be written. So that's a supervised.
You always write it in the same order, basically.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Did you try some other simple problems away from arithmetic, like maybe sorting?
Like no, sorting not, but we tried several problems which in the Saxton data set, like factorization. But
the general question is, like usually computer scientists think about problems in terms of big O of n, like time complexity of the problem. And correlates with the results that you have.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question because I can't hear you, it's so distant.
I'll try from another angle. Do you hear now? Hello?
Yes.
Okay, the question is usually computer science thinks about algorithms in terms of time complexity, like big O of n notation. And how does the time complexity of problems correlate with the results that you get with your approach on checkerboard?
Okay, now I understand the question. Right, so the time complexity, so the models learn a supervised signal. So if the supervised signal had time complexity, I don't know, n or n squared, then also the model use the same algorithm, so it remains the same complexity. So it's the model will stay very close to the.
I see. It learns like state by state each transition individually and reproduces that literally.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions? Yeah, there is one more question.
Have you considered what would be the impact of increasing the number of dimensions of the grid?
Yes, it's a very good question. That's one of our research questions. I have no idea what will happen, but that's an interesting question. I think the low dimensionality of the representation space is important, but that's just an intuition, and we have nothing on that yet. And I have no idea what will happen, but I hope that the performance will drop. That's my. I don't know.
Can I have a question too? That I'm not so. So the opposite question. So if you does it make any difference if you so is this checkered paper really important? So is it 2D? So have you tried doing the multiplication, let's say, just in 1D?
Right. Thanks, Christian. That's also a good question. I can't provide you an answer because we have not experimented with that. We started with the paper because it's. We wanted this natural thing, this easily understandable, and we want to be comparable with human condition, and that's the main reason. So the people, the regular people, do not calculate in a line, in a string. So I think it has some importance because it makes some algorithmic workings much more easier to work like humans do. So I think it's not critical. Things can be carried out in one dimension also, but that's also just an intuition that it could help the algorithmic process to utilize.
So I'm kind of skeptical because I think humans rely a lot on visual perception. That's the neural net. I mean, transformers essentially they are not really.
I understand your point. But here's another point that humans are also conditioned to imagine in two dimensions and three dimensions, and nobody imagine in four dimensions. So I know that's also a very vague argument, but there is something here, I think. So that's
what I mean. So my thesis is more like that we might just, like, it's an evolutionary thing that we have a very developed visual cortex, but if you it's not really important for an attention mechanism in an abstract space to be relying on a 2D grid if you don't have to. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, I would like to see whether this checkered paper at all that's a factor. So my bet would be it's not really a factor. But
okay, cool.
I mean, I would like to see how it works out.
I think it's a very very interesting question. I will keep you updated if we have any results regarding this question.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
So that my another comment is also that, I don't think that this gap that you mentioned is really a gap that is principally closable, because that gap is, that's a deep artificial intelligence question of saying, okay, if I give a step-by-step instruction to something and then you learn the policy on that, I mean, it's clearly, I mean, if the task is hard enough, then clearly there will always be a gap, right? Because you cannot really just like expect a deep learning system magically to learn any kind of complexity of a problem. So giving instructions on how to solve step by step should be an important privileged information, right? So that it's like you.
Yes. You clearly understand also this point, and I can't argue while I do not have results, but regarding this, but I think this is like a working hypothesis, and so that the reasoning happens in a child in grammar school or elementary school, it's basically pattern matching and algorithmic execution. Whether it's intelligence or it's necessary for general intelligence, or maybe the whole general intelligence is just reasoning like that. So this simple pattern matching, I don't know the answers, but I think it's an open question. So
my point is not that humans are kind of more, so that's all. My point is that there will be always a gap, that it's easier to learn by having demonstration than not having demonstration.
Right. That's right, yes.
But yeah, okay, cool.
I'm also like thinking like about the connection to the previous question about complexity. Like you are saying that there is this child learning, but it seems to me that Turing, when he sort of came up with the Turing machine, he sort of basically made that analogy with the tape. So I'm sort of wondering like why wouldn't you just be in a similar setting, learning like arbitrary Turing machines, basically.
Okay, so my point here is we want human mathematics, we want human cognition, and we I think we should stay as close to human cognition as we can. So a random Turing machine could came up with wild things, but I think that's important to analyze how these models working. So what are the inner workings of the details, and whether the details resemble human like reasoning. So here's the same thing like with the convolutional nets. So the convolutional nets inject inductive biases that are existing humans. So that the same feature detectors are in the visual cortex of the humans as as in the convolutional mess. So my point here is, let's stay as close to humanness as we can, and try to do things and analyze things in this setting with the new results of cognitive science. So if you, I don't know if I answered your question partly, at least.
I guess I'm wondering, like, if you have this algorithm, let's say for addition or multiplication, it's true that the children sort of learn, they are taught the algorithm at school. I wonder if they discovered that algorithm by themselves. Like, I'm not sure how human-like it is to discover that algorithm.
Right. I don't know. I don't know how a human could team up. Humans need prior knowledge. So once you have manipulated a lot of numbers, but I don't know the answer. So I could hypothesize, but I don't know the answers. How humans came up with the algorithms of addition. But if you have or anyone have any good pointers to results like these from cognitive sciences, I would happily thank that. But I don't know.
Okay. Any other questions in the room? We have time because the dinner is only at 7:30.
Okay, bon appetit.
Or like what we could do is also to have some like open discussion if the people who are present online, because we will have our discussion over the dinner, right? But if there are like any other things that people want to discuss related to this talk or to some previous talks, then this might be some opportunity. There doesn't seem to be any.
Hi, this is Peter Köpke here. Hi, Joseph. Hi, everybody. Can I just ask the recordings of the talks this afternoon? I wasn't able to attend this afternoon. Will they be available somewhere?
We will try. We have recorded the first session. We have half recorded the second session. Unfortunately, I forgot to switch on the recording because of all the technical issues. But in general, we will try to record everything. And we may also like figure out how to stream things on YouTube, but well, that may or may not happen. So the answer is yes, we will try. We might fail occasionally, but most of the time we might succeed.
Thank you very much. Good luck and also bon appetit.
Thank you.
Continuing on that point, could we suggest one place to discuss asynchronously in between the talks, maybe tonight, tomorrow morning? I think pretty much everybody or most people are on the lean loop. That might be a good place, just create a thread there, or anything that works for most people. That would be great because that way it may trigger some discussion that we can revisit the next day in that time that you allocated.
I'm not sure I understood. You want to reserve some time, slot, let's say in the morning for
open? Oh, no. It's great that to have some time to informally discuss at the end of the talks, but if we had some place to asynchronously discuss in the morning or at night for people that are online, that would may trigger some discussion points that we could cover the next day.
Yeah.
Like a Slack or Zoom or whatnot.
Or maybe the
Google group email list, whatever you suggest is good.
So you want something like Slack or Zoom to sort of continue continue the discussion around the talks.
Yeah, or come up with follow-up questions that we can cover the next day or something. Just some place to gather the discussion, because the Zoom chat closes with the Zoom meeting, right?
I don't know, anybody has some solutions, like I don't have a Slack account. I guess Zulip can be made into this. So, nobody is proposing anything in the room.
Like, I've heard people talk about Discord servers, which you can also do voice talking.
No, I think we want like a forum which is also possible to read offline. Like,
yeah, but the Discord you can, I think. I'm not entirely sure.
So what is it called again?
Discord.
Okay.
So Discord, you can use Slack. So I've been using Slack for my courses with the students, and voice is fine. But it's kind of commercial, sort of. So they, once you reach, I think, 10,000 messages, they start deleting some old history. They're saying, oh, you can pay. So I mean, I don't care, but some people might say that it's like a, like a some evil company that's done.
I know that Zulip is sort of open source, like free to use, basically, right? So we could use that. Well, I don't know. I have no experience with Discord, so I don't know if they are more or less commercial.
I think Discord is commercial, but it's very, very easy to make like your own instance of Discord. Like you guys just set up like a server they call it, but you don't have to do anything. You can just.
Okay. All right. Okay. So yeah, we might sort of investigate if anybody wants to do it for us. The work would be appreciated, but I can try myself, for example.
By show of hand, do most people are on the Lean Zulip already? No one.
So I doubt we have like too many people on the Zulip. Here.
So I am on it, but yeah. I mean, I think Zulip is really good. I mean, it's very easy to get started with Zulip. I like it, but it depends. It's easy to send out invitations for Zulip. But.
Yeah, that would be one way, right? Like, if there is. I think there is some Zulip machine learning for theorem improving thing, which I've been beautifully ignoring, sort of. But we could like invite everybody there and like just do it there, right? Like it might be better than just starting some new thing, right?
I think it's the easiest, but everything works for me.
Okay. Well, then why don't you do it, right?
I'll create a thread and I'll see a few people that I see there. And if anybody wants to rally, I'll send a link on the Zoom tomorrow afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, so if you can send me the link, then I can send it.
I'll send it on the Google Groups.
Okay, good. Anything else? So we have Georges Gontier chairing tomorrow the first session. We still need to figure out who is chairing the second session. And there will be some changes in the talks because some people cannot do it, but we might have some people who want to give a talk, which is not scheduled. So there might be some minor sessions changes tomorrow. If there is nothing else, then we can probably finish. so thanks to Adrian, I guess, for me. And see you tomorrow.